Hey, Stillman, how you doing?
Dave, I am sweaty.
You're profusely sweaty. You look like a patient I might be taking care of in the hospital.
What usually causes the profuse sweats for your patients?
Sepsis. So, is that what's going on? Hey, how's
Yeah.
your blood pressure?
It's good. I performed at-home surgery about a week ago, and I'm thinking I'm over the worst of it. We
We
got
got.
six toes on both feet now, Dave. That's the benefit. I grafted an extra toe on.
What is, does that give you like added balance, quickness? What are you
I
looking
wanted to
for?
try out for the neighborhood swim team. I heard it gives you extra push on the frog kick.
Well, you look great. I mean, you
Thanks.
look really sick, but let's do this. We've got our buddy Spence. He's here with us. He's the most frequent podcast guest, certainly. What's going on with you, Spence?
Hey, nothing really. Just a beautiful day here in Madison. That's the cause of Steel Sweat, I'm sure.
Yeah, I biked somewhere and just in time.
Steel, I biked today too, except I had two children on my bike. And
And
I didn't end up all sweaty, so I don't know what's wrong with you.
Yeah, there's not an ounce of sweat on Spence. He's glowing. He looks beautiful.
You should see
Fresh
Spence's
shaven.
legs. They're like tree trunks. Mine, I have these little twigs. It's hard for me to propel myself through space.
Well, and biking with a terrible viral infection, I don't recommend that, Steel. That's rough.
I heard you're supposed to sweat it out, Dave.
That is one thing. Cool. So guys, I've heard, you guys live in Madison. You both live there together, so you're able to be friendly, from what I understand.
It's true.
You guys get together and play basketball?
On a weekly basis, Dave.
What?
Yeah.
You get a weekly dose of Spence. I just get one like whenever he comes on the podcast, essentially.
You know, he talks probably 20 times more on the podcast than he does at basketball, though. I hear five or six words and I'm like, wow, had a pretty good conversation with Spence.
I'm all business at basketball, Steel.
Yeah. So we play a regular standing pickup game Thursday nights, 9 p.m. It's a late game, but Spence and
Wow.
I managed to drag ourselves out there. And the thing I love best about the game is Spence's fashion sense at these games. You have any idea how Spence is dressed or attired? Have you seen him play basketball, Dave?
I've never seen him do anything physical, so I'd be very interested to see how he's dressed. All I can picture is a polo tucked into some khakis.
There was a guy who played in that outfit once, but it wasn't Spence. It was the shift manager at Ross Dress for Less. No. So Spence used to have really long, awesome hair. And so if you start from the top, you just see these flowing, awesome locks. And then he would wear like a homemade headband, sweatband.
It was a strip of fabric from Emmeline's fabric collection.
So that looked always good. And then it was usually like a t-shirt from the mid to late 90s, normal basketball shorts. And then he'll often wear like high fashion socks, sometimes mismatched, often mismatched, but lots of bold colors, lots of stripes, lots of patterns. Think like an Italian businessman is doing well for himself. That's what Spence is wearing. And then always, always, probably the best basketball shoes ever made. Spence, what brand of shoes do you wear? I don't recall.
It's Saucony, the only kind of basketball shoes.
So like women's Saucony canvas shoes. They're amazing.
I did actually have a pair of women's Sauconys that I used to wear. I have a dream though that someday I'll come dressed in like fancy dress shoes, just to make the point that you don't need nice shoes to be a good basketball player.
Yeah.
Wait, Steel, what kind of kicks are you wearing here? Are they like LeBron James,
Yeah, definitely.
signature brand?
No, I've got these purple, like they're maroon colored Adidas. I bought them 3 or 4 years ago. I got them on super sale. So that's
High
why I wear them.
tops?
Yeah,
Are
high
they high
tops for
tops?
sure. Yeah.
Oh,
They're
nice.
like concrete boats.
I'd like to see you in some Starberries, Stefan Marbury's signature shoe.
I'd really like to get them, but Dave and Barry's or whatever, Stephen Barry's closed. They were the exclusive outlet for it, and they went bankrupt.
Oh, jeez. at least get trying. Doesn't Ewing, Patrick Ewing, I think, has a signature shoe.
He still
as well.
Makes them. Yeah, the Ewings. I should get some of those.
Yeah, that could help.
It'd improve my post game.
I find that there's a correlation between the cost of a basketball player's shoes and their seriousness on the court.
So I only wear those Spalding Olajuwons from Payless. Those shoes dominate. No, but we play pickup, and there's a cast of characters. And I was going to ask Spence who maybe your top three favorite players at this game are.
So easily my top teammate is probably this guy named Sebastian. He's French.
Oh, yeah. This guy's awesome.
He's the best to play with because maybe it's because he's European or something. I don't know. He's taller, and he's a really good shooter, and he's an excellent passer. And when I play basketball, I take much more joy in making an awesome pass than I do in making a great shot. I would so much rather just throw an amazing pass that makes everybody kind of like, you know, wow, what just happened?
For Spence, it's all about aesthetics. His basketball game is purely about beauty. He doesn't care about points. He doesn't care about muscle, finesse. It's just beauty. I love watching Spence. Whenever I sit out, I'm always cheering for Spence.
So Spence is more of a Golden State Warrior and less of a Cleveland Cavalier.
100%.
Like.
Yeah, he's a Warrior or a Spurs. Actually, watching Spence and Sebastian play is like watching the Spurs play a little bit. They just move the ball beautifully.
I used to love the Spurs growing up, and I don't really care about any specific team now, but I do have a soft spot for the Spurs, and I do think they reflect the kind of play that I aspire to.
There's an anti-Sebastian, too, at the game, and that's probably Will, would you say?
Yeah, probably.
Bull in a china shop?
He's larger. I mean, he's not like – he's just thickly built, bigger than most of the people there. Very serious about his game. He's like he's the kind of player that if you block his shot or, like, steal the ball from him, the next time down the court, you know he's, like, all over your case trying to steal the ball back because he has to prove – That you can't best him, you know?
Yeah. That sounds like my kind of player. I prefer an isolation-based scheme. I just want the rock, you know, to be stopped, and I want you to be serious about it.
Then you're Will's dream teammate, because he's a great shooter, probably the best pure scorer there, but he's a total black hole. The ball goes in and never comes back out, which is fine
Perfect.
With me, because I don't shoot. I just pass to him, and I'm like, all right, sweet. Will just scored 11 points. We won.
Yeah, if he wants to take over a game, he can, and he is very talented. It is very satisfying because you can tell when he's going to spot up for a three.
Yes,
from like ridiculous ranges, and every once in a while you can see it coming and all come out of nowhere and like either cause some trouble or even block it, and it makes him so mad.
Spence has blocked a couple of his threes. It's incredible. It's so good.
There's nothing I like more than showing up somebody who cares way more than I do.
All right, Spence, who's your wild card? Who's the third iconic pickup player at our game?
This has got to be James. He's been a fixture. He kind of heads the operation up. You can almost guarantee at least once per night he's going to get injured or at least kind of writhing on the floor for a minute.
Pounding then, the floor, like you thought his life has ended. You're like, oh, that's a double compound fracture for sure. Minimum. Yeah.
And then he's back at it like 5 minutes later, and he's fine. He's not an awful player or anything. I mean, he can shoot the ball reasonably well and can dribble and pass, and it's not like he's a total mess. But he's defensively, his strategy tends to be
foul the hell out of everyone.
Foul as much as possible and call your own fouls as little as possible. Yeah, well, there was this one of my favorite nights. He had his entire family there. Or not entire, but a lot of his siblings and his dad was in town.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. The whole family was kind of like, it was carbon copies in the sense that like couldn't do anything without getting like totally mauled on the way to the basket. That was an interesting evening.
It was incredible too, because it was the one evening where James didn't go down in a heap injured.
Yeah.
He was like a tough guy for one night. Because his dad was there.
Yeah. Those were fun times.
Yeah, those were the days, Dave. You got to come out to Madison and play pickup basketball with us sometime.
You guys are selling me on it just from the entertainment factor. I'm terrible at basketball, but I love watching people be way too serious about stuff. So I'm in.
Okay.
The other Yeah, some great characters. Great
it's an awesome study in human communication, really, these games.
Exactly. Yeah, all the different personalities and how they combine. And the teams change every week, and even between games we'll often switch up teams. So there's like an endless combination of people, and never
it's
a dull
thing
moment.
Of beauty. Thing of beauty, Spence.
Yeah. Well, guys, this just naturally leads into the rest of our show almost seamlessly. We're going to talk about a little while back we did some assigned reading. We're going to talk about the books that we assigned each other, and we're going to give new assignments out. We're also going to get Spence. He's going to be our expert testimony today. Spence is an urban planner. He's got some ideas, and we've got lots of questions. Specifically, I'm going to talk to him about Walt Disney's dreams of urban planning for the future. I want to see what Spence thinks. And of course, we'll finish off with some Unchained Melodies and some book wisdom. But first, we're going to talk about the books that we read. Spence, me and Steele got together and we assigned you to read Crying of Lot 49 by Thomas Pynchon. What did you think?
Yeah, I've been kind of excited to talk about this because I'm wondering what in the world was enjoyable about that book. That was a little bit of an exaggeration. There were parts, things that I liked about it. I think he's pretty clever, but I'm very much a story person, and I care less about how you tell the story than what the story is that you're telling. And so this was like a non-story. So for me, I couldn't get into it very well. There is no ending. It just kind of ends abruptly without anything actually happening. There's really no climax to the story. And it's not even clear for the first, half of the novella, what is shaping, like, if you ask me halfway through, what is this about? I wouldn't really have much to say.
Spence is totally into postmodern fiction, Dave.
I loved the kind of meandering nature of it. Yeah, it's really about scenes. It's about kind of weird, funny characters and ideas. And I absolutely love how it ends. And I don't want to spoil the ending to a 50-year-old novel, but it's fantastic. Like, I don't want any more. I want it to end right where it did. I've had people tell me before, like, but then what happens next? Like, that's the point. It ends right there. It's great.
You could spoil the ending, though, because there really isn't one.
If Dave was in the same room with you, Spence, he totally would have punched you. You should have seen that face he just made.
Honestly, it's one of my, like, as far as endings to books, it's one of my favorite endings to a book. The whole book, there's like a weird conspiracy around like postage stamps, which sounds ridiculous.
No, it sounds great. It sounds super interesting.
Yeah, what's more interesting than postage stamps, especially ancient ones?
Yeah.
I wrote a song based on this book once. It was fantastic.
Was it called Thurn in Taxis?
I did have the game Thurn in Taxis for a while. It was about ancient postal routes. It was a terrific game.
How did that game end? Inconclusively?
It usually ended with me having the sweetest mail route. But I don't even know what to say. I think it's great. I'll spoil the ending. So she's going to this auction. She's finally going to figure out this conspiracy because they're auctioning off all this collection of stamps that's related to the conspiracy. And that's Lot 49. And as soon as she gets there, that's like the book's over. And I just thought it was hilarious. I thought it was a really interesting, funny way to end the book.
Because the book is making you feel like the whole point of the book is to uncover what's really happening in this conspiracy. But then the book tells you, actually, that's not the point since we're not unraveling any part of the conspiracy. It's producing these expectations of genre that it intentionally frustrates and intentionally doesn't fulfill. It's trying to make you mad, Spence.
It succeeded. No, I'm being harsher on it than I enjoyed reading it. It's not one that I will read and reread.
So, Spence, it sounds like you're giving more of a thumbs down if you were doing the thumbs measurement.
I would say
he wouldn't have used a thumb. He would have used a different finger altogether, Dave. He's like, it's not the thumb or the index finger. I'd have used the finger right next to it. That's what he told me.
I would highly recommend it to certain types of people. I would not recommend it to other types of people. And I am one of those types of people that I would not recommend it to. How's that for a response?
I just feel like that you would recommend it to someone that's a douchebag and not to someone that's not a douchebag. Like, you're more of a douche. I think you'd be into this.
Now you're projecting your own ideas, Dave.
Well, I'm glad we're getting your thoughts about it. But I'm excited to hear what Steele has to say about his assignment, because I love this book. And I feel like you must have liked it, right, Steele?
I have to say, Dave, this is probably the worst book I've read in the last 3 years.
Are you being...
No, I'm kidding. I just wanted to see how much we could crush you here, Dave. Both of the books you recommend and we both hate. Want to let you know, we're never talking to you again. We're just going to end this episode early.
I don't want to do this segment anymore. Sign reading's stupid.
Segment's over. Okay, no, actually, Dave, you assigned me to read Hyperion by Dan Simmons. And I have to say, it was genre fiction. I think it's future sci-fi, and it's got a bit of horror elements in it as well. And yeah. So I went in thinking, oh, it's just going to be genre fiction. It'll be a fun, quick read or whatever. I'm not going to like it that much. And it was surprisingly literary. I thought it was very well written for genre fiction. And maybe that's just my own prejudices or biases, but I was impressed. I thought Hyperion was great. I went on and read The Fall of Hyperion, which wasn't as good of a book, but it resolved a lot of stuff. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think when I read it, because I read quite a bit of science fiction, I also like to read the actual like literature. So I really liked it because I felt like the two worlds were meeting.
Definitely.
He uses like the Canterbury Tales kind of structure to the book. They're going on this weird pilgrimage to meet this terrifying being called the Shrike. And the stories are just really interesting, really compelling. And yeah, I went on to read the other book as well. It's somewhat of a letdown. Like, I almost wanted just everything to be left in the air.
Yeah.
Because it was really interesting.
All right, Dave. So here's a question for you. There's like, what, 6 or 7 pilgrims that are going to Hyperion to meet the Shrike? Who's your favorite pilgrim and who's your least favorite?
Well, it's been a while since I read it. I like the narrator. The narrator of the book is probably my favorite pilgrim. He's just very likable, and he's the one taking you through the story. So you're naturally going to feel more for him. It's easy to win me over if you're the one that I'm reading. Like, oh, yeah, I like this guy.
Okay.
And then what's the...
There's Martin Silenus, who's the poet. There's Bronn Lamia, who's the super swole lady from that dense gravity planet.
Uh-huh.
There's Saul Weintraub, the Jewish ethics professor. Fedmin Kassad, who's like the super warrior. Het Mastin, who's the Templar. And then Father Lenar Hoyt.
And of the stories, I felt most intrigued by Father Lenar Hoyt's story. Isn't it the one where... Which one is the one where they die and there's like a weird rebirth?
The Bikura or the Bikuna or whatever, that's the Lenar Hoyt story. That's the first one in the book. That one's totally gripping.
Yeah. As soon as you're jumping in, I really liked him, and I really like the poet as well. I just think he's an interesting character, more so than just his story.
Wow. Okay, Dave. Silenus was my least favorite character. I didn't like the poet. Yeah. But my favorite was Saul Weintraub. I liked him best. Actually, who I wanted my favorite to be, and I was kind of bummed, this was the big disappointment of the Het Mastin, the Templar.
Uh-huh.
You just never get to know him, really. He's the mysterious character the whole way. And I was like, man, I want his story. I want his story so bad.
It's just, that whole book is weird. I mean, it's out there, science fiction. The whole character of the Shrike, he's the Lord of Pain, and they're going to meet the Shrike for reasons that are terrifying to me, and people get like visions of being placed on the Tree of Pain. I don't like horror, but I loved this book anyway, because it definitely the Shrike was this terrible horror element. When I read this, I told every story to Ariane, my wife, and she was eating it up, because it was just really interesting, compelling stories, and the Shrike was like almost in my nightmares after that.
The Shrike is intense, and then I was real impressed. I like the ousters, man. By the end, I like the ousters a lot.
So you're giving it a thumbs up, if that's what we're doing for our assigned reading.
Yeah, Dave, I will give it a thumbs up.
Man, that's 2 thumbs up still, because there's one from me as well.
Hyperion. Dan Simmons, big thumbs up. You know, I even recommended it to my father-in-law, Dave. Told him he should check this out.
Wow. Do you think he did he pick up on it? Do you think it's going to happen?
I think so. He reads a lot of sci-fi, I think. So he says he sounds vaguely familiar. He might have already read it, but I'm going to get him a copy and we'll see for sure.
Suspense, if you want to learn about the Lord of Pain and the Tree of Pain, I'd recommend picking up Hyperion as well.
I'll have to check that out.
All right, Dave, what about your book? I recommended Among Murderers for you.
It was an interesting book. As I was reading it still, I kept thinking there's something in my mind. I was like, hey, what's wrong with this author? Just the way she was presenting stuff and the way she would talk about how she's interacting with these people. And then it was about halfway through the book, I realized, oh, she's German. She has no sense of humor. And like, it totally explained, like, I was thinking like she had like some type of real issue, but she's just German. So like anytime someone makes a joke to her in the book, she's like,
what is
understand.
This? Is this joke? That wasn't a very good German accent, but the spirit is still there.
So just that alone was pretty interesting. Just the character of the narrator of this nonfiction book, like really colored it because she didn't understand a lot of the humor and a lot of the cultural things. And I thought that was really funny.
That's true. I had forgotten about how great that part is.
Really, that was probably my favorite part. But you know, the book is about she's going following three men that are released from prison that had been involved in murders and just really showing their plight. And when you assigned it to me, I was thinking, like, this book's going to just be, like, kind of making me want to feel terrible for these murderers. And I don't think it – I think that was its agenda to a certain extent, but it didn't – it wasn't just, like, making me cry for these guys. It
right,
was just
exactly.
Really directly presenting what they're going through and how this really is a problem. And it didn't, like, take away their culpability for what they did. It mm-hmm. just said this is an issue in society. So I liked that it was – a much more balanced presentation than I was expecting.
I appreciated that about it too, Dave. And Spence, I don't think you've read this, have you?
I have not.
Okay, so the idea is like, just imagine you're 18 years old, you're put in prison for murder and you're expecting to serve a long time. Let's say 30 to 35 years later, you get released. So you're now in your late 40s, early 50s, possibly even older, and you've spent the vast majority of your life in maximum security prison. So you're coming out to a world that has happened without you. And the last time you were in that world, you were a teenager. And the book kind of goes through all of these small and big things that these men have to readjust to, like the experience of being on the street with people really close to you, having to cross the street, and how it felt very awkward and uncomfortable, and they weren't sure when they were supposed to follow traffic signals and not. They talked about readjusting trying to date or having sexual experiences and how strange and difficult and complex that was, about finding employment, about finding housing, all the kind of normal, ordinary adult things that we do, and how it hadn't been a part of their frame of reference for some 30 some years.
That sounds like so this is a work of fiction, right?
No, this is nonfiction.
Okay.
This woman was getting her master's degree in journalism at NYU. Her name's Sabine Heinlein. And as Dave said, she's German. And so she started writing a piece about this story, and it became a book eventually that was just published a year or two ago.
Yeah, I think not having been in prison myself and, you know, the majority of the populace and definitely everybody that I associate with on a regular basis has not been there. It seems like something that's hidden in plain view, kind of.
Yeah, for sure. Know?
Yeah, I think it really opened up a world that I wasn't familiar with. It probably wasn't my favorite book I've ever read, but I thought it was an interesting thing and an interesting exercise just to kind of understand that aspect of society a little bit more. And it really calls into question kind of the efficacy of our whole prison system. Like, what is the purpose of it? What are we trying to accomplish by putting these guys in prison?
Like how well we're rehabilitating or reintegrating people?
Yeah, I think even more so, like, the whole thing. Like, I don't know if, you know, we as a society could answer, like, why are we sending this man to prison?
Is it a punitive thing, or is it to maintain safety because we think they're dangerous, or is it because we feel like they have a chance of rehabilitation? We haven't really settled that question.
I recommended it to another friend of mine just because it's a short book, so it was a quick read. Yeah, I give it a thumbs up. and a huge thumbs up for it being by a German woman, so that partway through I was like, does she have like real problems? And I was like, no, she's German.
She's not autistic. She's German.
That should be on a t-shirt or something.
Yeah. You know, Dave, I was proud of myself too, because I have an enormous prejudice against Germans, and yet I liked this book and I still read it.
This is very true. Steele has, it is definitely an enormous prejudice.
On my mission in England, one of the last companions I was partnered with, he was German, and he literally had no sense of humor. Like, it was just those 6 weeks that I was with him, like, we could not communicate. I just about had to like write letters back and forth for anything to be communicated, because we just were on the opposite pages.
It sounds like that should be the subject of a book. I think that might be entertaining.
Life with a German.
Translating humor into German.
Yeah.
So let's talk about our next reading assignments.
I got a book for you, Dave. This is from the genre fiction category.
Oh, nice.
This was the first piece of genre fiction I had read for a long, long time. I used to go home teaching with a guy named Thomas Hennage, and he was telling me about this Mormon fantasy writer who was great. And I thought, that's sweet of you. You're trying to have common interests with me because, you know, I'm an English major. Okay. I can't wait to read fantasy fiction by a Mormon author. That's going to be awesome, you know? He told me about this guy named Brandon Sanderson, and so I looked him up, and apparently he was chosen by Robert Jordan's widow to finish the Wheel of Time series. And Robert Jordan's like a huge name in fantasy. So I thought, oh, okay, maybe he can actually write. And so the book that he recommended to me was called Warbreaker. And it was one that he published as he was writing it, the whole thing online. He would post chapter drafts for free for his fans as he was revising them. And then eventually the whole book is available for free as a free download. I think you'll like it, Dave. It's an interesting kind of premise. There's a cool kind of twist on the fantasy story. And it's kind of like Highlander, but with color. I'll just
say
that.
Excellent. Do you think like how he released it, do you think that colored like the structure of the book?
I don't know. I didn't know that he released it that way until after I read it. So I just read it as a work of fiction. And I didn't have a big reference point because I wasn't really a genre fiction reader. But it read as like a, you know, kind of a cliffhanger every chapter kind of thing.
Well, I'll read it. You know, I like genre fiction.
So, yeah, that's my recommendation for you.
Yeah, I had a book for you too, Dave. This is called Bread and Wine. It's by an Italian author named Ignazio Silone. Steele actually gave me a biography of the author, which I have not read yet, Steele. Sorry.
Neither did I, so I was hoping you'd read it and tell me about it.
It's a really interesting book. I read it when I was in school. I got a minor in Italian.
Isn't that illegal?
Isn't what illegal?
Getting a minor in Italian?
Uh-oh.
Not if you're Berlusconi.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Good.
Anyway, so the premise is there's this guy who is a communist agitator who comes back to Italy from exile during the rise of Mussolini. He has to basically disguise himself so that he doesn't get found out. So he goes and lives as a priest amongst these peasants. And it's really interesting the way that he starts to view ideologies after spending time with these simple folks that don't really have ideology. So I guess kind of a tale about, well, about Italy in that specific time, which was under great turmoil, but then just in general, kind of the author's view on ideologies, I guess. Really interesting.
All right. I'll give it a go. Me and my wife read a while ago, a Graham Greene book. I think it was called Power and the Glory. This just makes me think of it for whatever reason, but it was about a priest. I believe he's in Mexico. They had basically outlawed the Catholic Church. So he's just kind of going from town to town secretly doing baptisms and stuff. And it pretty interesting book too. All right. So Steele.
Yeah, I'm ready.
We've got a couple books that we're going to give you.
Lay it on me, Dave. What am I going to read next?
Steele, I keep making you read science fiction. I think this will be the last science fiction book I'm going to make you read for a while, just because it's got to stop somewhere. But if it's going to stop, it probably has to stop with one of the greatest science fiction books ever written, Frank Herbert's Dune.
Oh,
have you ever read this?
I've never read it. I've heard about it. I've heard it's great. Never read it.
It's amazing. And there's like 30 books in the series. I would recommend it against reading any further than just this one. You'll just be disappointed. Don't read any more. But this book is just fantastic. It's, you know, it's the sandworms, sand dunes, surviving in the desert, wearing weird suits that reclaim your urine and feces so you can drink the water out of there.
I think Germans do that in real life.
Yeah, this is based on Germany, actually. Just a whole weird universe. It is a weird book. It's okay. Out there, and it's one of my favorite books I've ever read.
Awesome.
There's also a movie adaptation, is that correct?
If you want to watch a fantastic film, don't watch this one. But if you want to watch like a really, really weird movie, you watch David Lynch's Dune. I own it. I've probably watched it like 10 times. David Lynch did the film adaptation of it, and it is it's totally David Lynch doing a science fiction fantasy epic with a huge budget in the 80s. It's, you got Sting, you got everybody. It's amazing.
Wow. I'm sold. I'm in. All right, Spencer, what do you want me to read?
So this is a book that we've talked about in the past. It's by a guy named Nassim Nicholas Taleb. He has a series of books that all revolve around the same thing, but this is kind of the magnum opus. It's a book called Anti-Fragile.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a nonfiction. He got his start as an options trader on Wall Street. So he's from, I think it's Lebanon. And he is obsessed with variance and risk. So the whole book is basically, we have this notion of fragility, which is that if there's a major change in something's state, it can break. But we don't really have a concept for what is anti-fragile. And what he means by that is there are certain things where when circumstances change, they actually get stronger. So he uses an example of weightlifting. When you lift weights, you're subjecting your body to a certain amount of stress, but that actually forces your body to get stronger. So that would be an anti-fragile activity. So the whole book is about how to structure our lives and our systems in ways that take advantage of anti-fragile properties rather than making them fragile, which is what most of our systems are at the moment. So
I'm sold, Spence. You know, after you recommended it, I started his first book. And I'm a couple chapters in. It's really, really good. I'm super impressed. Thanks for the recommendation. And I'm going to get to Anti-Fragile soon.
Oh, Fooled by Randomness.
Yeah, that's the one. It's great. Yeah.
He's awesome. And he's like, it's ridiculous how smart he is. Mm-hmm. He'll bring in like ancient philosophers and like 16th century playwrights and all kinds of, I mean, he's just got this base of knowledge that is amazing.
I'm impressed. I like it a lot.
So we got reading assignments for Spence as well. I read this book a few years ago, and I loved it. Yeah, Alexander Dolgan, An American in the Gulag. It's essentially just the story of his life. Basically, he was working in the American embassy in Moscow, abducted by the Soviets for almost no reason, and was in prison for decades.
When was this, Dave? When did he get imprisoned?
It was in the 50s.
Oh, wow. I've never heard of this.
Amazing. So he ends up being in the prison for decades. They do all sorts of things to him to try and get him to confess to some type of anti-Soviet conspiracy. They sleep deprivation. They don't give him a bed. They physically abuse him until finally they just send him to the gulag and say, you're out, you're staying out there.
So I saw that this was your recommendation. I did a little bit of research, and apparently he met with Solzhenitsyn, and he said that he had never met anybody who stayed sane after coming back from the gulag except this one guy.
Wow. That's American spirit for you.
That's right. Ruskies.
And one of the most interesting things is he talks about his different strategies of how he maintains sanity. And one thing, he's in a prison cell that's like, you know, 3x7. And he paces back and forth and counts his paces. And he keeps track, and he just like imagines himself walking from Moscow to Paris, and he counts how many paces that would take. And that's just one of the things he does to maintain sanity.
Okay.
What do you got for him, Steele?
This is a book by a behavioral economist, I believe is what he does. Israeli born. His name is Daniel Kahneman, and the book is called Thinking Fast and Slow. He and Nassim Taleb are friends, and they respect each other, Spence. And this is about thinking, how our minds work, and some common errors of thinking, and how we can become aware of our unintentional and our intentional biases and use some kind of quirks and flaws of our brain to become smarter people, I guess, and make better decisions. It seems like right up your alley, Spence.
Yeah, so Nassim Taleb does like Daniel Kahneman a lot, and he tends to hate economists.
Yeah.
So it's like the one economist that he likes. And that's because Daniel Kahneman's work is basically pointing out how economics makes some really false assumptions.
About human rationality.
About human nature, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so check it out, Spence.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So guys, we have our reading assignments. We got some stuff to do. Steele, you're going to learn a lot about sandworms. It's exciting. So now we're going to go expert testimony. Spence is an urban planner. Tell us what that means. What are we talking about, Spence?
Basically, an urban planner is somebody who's interested in how cities grow and how they function.
When I look at this, into this issue at all, it's pretty clear that Europe is winning in the urban planning war, if there was such a war. What's going on? Why does Europe win?
Well, it depends on how you define winning. Europe does some things better than we do, and there may be things that we do better than Europe.
No, let's be honest. Come on, Spence. We're not beating Europe. Come on.
Yeah. So
maybe places like Seattle or something like that.
Yeah.
They're only part American anyway.
Those lefties. Europe has an advantage in that a lot of their cities are a lot older than American cities and got a lot bigger before American cities got big. They kind of developed in a different time. So maybe a good example would be Phoenix versus Amsterdam. So
Phoenix wins every measure.
Yeah. I mean, who
That's
wants
my hometown, Spence. Come on.
So Phoenix is kind of a poster child of modernity. It grew during the time when everybody drove around in cars. We had air conditioning in our houses. And that was really what fueled the growth. And now we have this gigantic metropolitan area where in order to get anywhere, you pretty much expect to drive your car somewhere. And the only way you can survive during the summer is by cranking the air conditioning. And it's hard to not insert value judgments into discussions about planning. So I'm trying not to be overly critical. But from certain standpoints, that's not I hate to use the word sustainable. That's not a way of life that can continue as the price of oil gets higher and as we start to care more about environmental issues like water conservation and things like that. So Amsterdam developed, on the contrary, during a time when it was there were no cars. So your house had to be within walking distance of where you worked. You couldn't expect large inflows of oil from Saudi Arabia or wherever. You didn't have the modern mechanical systems for air conditioning and cooling or whatever else. The way the city is built reflects a time where I guess cities and regions had to be more self-reliant. Yeah, more subject to constraints and just kind of living within your means, I guess, is a way to think of it.
So, that sounds un-American to me, Spence. We don't want to live within our means.
Yeah. We want to take on massive amounts of debt to build ever larger roads. So,
you got to dream big.
A lot of European cities have that advantage. I think another advantage, and I guess you could think of this as an advantage or not, in the aftermath of World War II, most of Europe had been devastated. You know, they just bombed whole cities into rubble.
Yeah, huge advantage.
So these cities were very poor.
Another advantage, yes.
I'm getting there. The advantage is that because they were poor, they were unable to spend billions of dollars basically running highways through the middle of their towns. And so you have a lot of European cities whose urban fabric has remained intact, whereas a place like Boston or Milwaukee or Chicago has neighborhoods that have been entirely cut off from the rest of the city because we've dug trenches to put freeways through. And there's a very real isolating effect from doing that. So these European cities that didn't have the money to do that never had the opportunity to basically kill off parts of their cities. And now that we've had, you know, decades of experience and reflection, we realize that that was maybe not the best thing to do, or at least more and more people are coming to that conclusion. But because the Europeans couldn't make that mistake in the first place, they now are benefiting from, I guess, their misfortune at the time.
I feel like knowing you for a long time, studying urban and regional planning has impacted your worldview and kind of your big picture of the world and how you live pretty substantially. But for you, how has the discipline that you studied and the knowledge that you've gained from your field impacted how you conduct your life?
That's a good question. I think there's kind of a feedback loop. I've always been interested in urban issues and cities in general.
Because you came from Idaho Falls?
Yeah, because I came from a really urban city. So I will never live in a neighborhood that I feel restricts my options for getting around to basically just driving a car somewhere. And that's my own personal preference. But part of that view is informed by my understanding of urban issues and how certain development patterns can affect our well-being as people and our well-being as a society.
Hmm.
And so I guess it informs my worldview, but I kind of allow it to inform my worldview because I'm already predisposed to feel that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. So what do you work with, or what do you study now? Like, what part of urban planning do you do, and why do you do it?
So I've focused on transportation, and specifically the firm that I work for does a lot of bicycle and pedestrian stuff. We design infrastructure, we do studies. I feel like that's my own natural inclination. I really enjoy bikes. I really enjoy other forms of transportation. And that's not to say I hate driving. We own a car and we use our car pretty regularly. But I think having options is a good thing. And so I hope that I'm working towards building a world where people have options.
So do you feel like, is there a city in the United States that you feel like is doing really well at this, providing people different options for transportation, providing them options for how to get to work and where to work?
I think different cities are doing different things that are good. The example that always gets trotted out is Portland, and they certainly have been innovative, especially when it comes to bicycling. They've really made a push. All of the bike infrastructure that Portland has put in place in the last like decade or two, which has really skyrocketed their status as a biking city to basically the top of American cities. They've basically spent the amount of money that it costs to build a mile of urban freeway. So what they did is they decided we can either spend, you know, several million dollars on, you know, making it easier to get around in a car, which it already was a reasonably easy place to navigate in a car, or we can really push for better bike infrastructure and provide people those alternatives. And it turns out that their investment has paid off, and they now have, just in terms of people getting to and from work, I think it's about 6% of the population, which doesn't sound like a lot, but compared to other American cities, is easily maybe 3 or 4 times the kind of average large city share that of people that are bicycling. And that's only people commuting to work. So that doesn't include things like going to the grocery store or going to the park or school or other things.
Do you bike to work, Spence?
I do.
I bike to work sometimes, and I love to bike to work in the summer. But the big deterrent for me is that I sweat profusely, and I'm like, sweet, I just bike to work in the summer. You saw me at the beginning of this podcast. I'm just now drying off, and it's sort of disgusting in a work environment.
My strategy is that I refuse to sweat.
Oh, okay.
Cool like a cucumber.
I am lucky in that way. I don't tend to sweat, I think, as much as some people.
Yeah, that's kind of you not to mention me by name.
The other thing, a lot of workplaces are wising up to this, and so many places have showers that are available. My building actually does have a shower, so if I wanted to, I could use that, and I would just leave earlier in the morning and then take my shower at work.
Man, I want them to put a shower in my building. That'd be sweet.
Yeah, and I don't know. The university may have something. I'd be surprised if they didn't have any.
Well, I just have to wash in the sink, and I'm standing there naked. Yeah. Everybody's staring at me, and I'm like, I just biked to work.
Yeah.
Listen, it's Madison.
Well, if you bike naked, you're already like halfway done. So there's that option. I also work for a company where everybody bikes. And so people don't really get as weirded out by the sweat thing. You just come to work and you're a little bit sweaty. And after a few minutes, you're fine. So maybe that's a cultural shift that has to happen. But I do know a lot of newer buildings have showers and better accommodations for people that are biking in.
Yeah, a lot of buildings are indoor plumbing as well now still.
Ah, cool.
Toilets indoor. They're doing all sorts of stuff with these pipes. So Spence, do you think it's okay for these bike guys to be waving their fists in anger all the time? What's your thoughts on that?
I think that's an unfortunate meme that has really attached itself to bikers. And I kind of understand where it comes from. There are certain, I see bikers. I used to commute in Chicago every day, and I lived in the city and rode all the way into the loop for work. And I would see bikers do some really dumb things. The truth is everybody does dumb things. I see drivers doing dumb things all the time too. So
yeah. You ever heard of road rage, Dave?
So it's unfortunate that bikers get singled out for that. In another sense, I understand why a cyclist would feel threatened. So a lot of people that drive maybe don't have experience biking on the roads. And I don't think they understand the level to which if you're on a bike, you feel your existence threatened by the presence of cars. I mean, you're literally one small mistake from death. So I don't mean to make biking sound more dangerous than it is. The truth is it's actually a pretty safe activity, but you are constantly aware of that threat that, that cars pose. So I'm lucky because I live off of a path that does not have vehicular traffic. It's simply a bike path that goes all the way, almost all the way to my office. So the vast majority of my commute, I don't really interact with cars whatsoever. And I really like that. But the times when I am riding out on the road, even when I'm in a bike lane, it's just constantly in the back of your mind that one driver could do something really stupid and you could end up at the hospital. So I think the reason bikes, you know, certain cyclists adopt that attitude is it's more kind of like a defensive mechanism. You feel threatened. And so you're naturally going to respond aggressively to any situation. And a driver may be totally oblivious.
Like a silverback gorilla sort of thing. That's how the gorillas operate as well.
That's right. So the driver may not realize they've even done something that made the bicyclist feel threatened. And that's a problem with just the nature of driving, is that there really is no feedback mechanism. You as a driver would have no idea that something you do is annoying to everybody else on the road, because the only way to communicate annoyance when you're driving is to honk your horn, or as a cyclist, to like wave your fist.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask you, Spence. What are your preferred hand motions or gestures to express anger on a bike? What do you think really gets drivers' attention?
Nothing really does, and I tend to just kind of shake my head. And there have been times where somebody did something dangerous, and I pulled up to a light next to them and kind of was like, what the heck are you doing, you know?
Oh, man, you dropped the H-bomb on them, Spence?
But, you know, usually those conversations aren't that positive, and you're not really going to gain anything from it. I try to be polite when a driver does something nice. It's like if I'm waiting to cross the road and they stop for me, I'll wave, you know, so that they feel like I am.
You don't shake your fist. You don't act as if you were entitled to that. You know, go, you're darn right.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I think there's a lot of ignorance about traffic law. So, for example, here in Wisconsin, at least, it is state law that if a cyclist or a pedestrian is waiting to cross at a crosswalk, a driver on the road is legally obligated to stop and let that person cross. So technically, when I'm waiting to cross a road and I'm at the path, I would be in the right to basically, you know, come out in front of the car because it's their job to stop. I realize for self-preservation reasons, that's a stupid way to do things. And the law is maybe a little bit ambiguous about things. But, you know, most drivers, if you ask them, probably would not realize that it's actually their legal obligation to stop.
Yeah,
so part of
true.
It is just education on the part of cyclists and drivers.
We got a good question for you here. Dave wrote this one, but I wanted to ask Spence, get your take on it. Why do restaurants like to put urban in their title these days? And when it comes down to it, would you rather eat an urban cookie or just a cookie?
I will eat a cookie in any form. Dave and I are kindred souls in that regard. So if it has sugar in it, then I'm in.
Okay.
As far as the urban trend, I think it's just a general trend on the part of the population. There's been a lot written about the return to cities. And so, like, for decades, people were kind of fleeing the cities. So you have the term white flight, basically people leaving for suburbs because the black people had moved in these northern industrial cities. So the white people that could afford to left and went to the suburbs. That trend is starting to reverse to a certain extent. Some central cities are really booming in population. Phoenix probably is, for example, like downtown Phoenix. D.C. and New York and Chicago are definitely seeing this trend. So the urban lifestyle is really kind of capturing the mind of the up-and-coming generations. And I think the restaurants are trying to kind of grab onto that trend.
Hmm. I have some more questions. Walt Disney is a huge fan of the future and urban planning. Do you fall in line with Disney's view of the future, or do you feel like yourself you're disagreeing with what Disney wants for us?
I assume you're referring to Epcot Center.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. So I don't know to what extent Disney espoused this, but there was certainly kind of a modernist view of cities. It's kind of the towers in the park is what planners call it. You have these really tall skyscrapers that are surrounded by grass and open space. And everybody gets around by driving from one tower to the other. And there's this French architect named Le Corbusier who was kind of the flag bearer or standard bearer for this type of thinking. And it really took hold here in the United States, more so than in other places. It has now proven to be kind of a failure. And you see this with like housing projects. Cabrini Green in Chicago is an example where they built these towers that were surrounded by grassy areas. And it was supposed to be this healthy, nurturing space where poor people could have access to the fresh air and the open space that all the suburbanites had, but in the middle of the city. And it really failed. And it failed because it took this kind of top-down and one-size-fits-all approach, which is prone to mistakes. And when those shocks come, rather than getting stronger, a city that's built in that style tends to suffer. And so these public housing projects have been failures and have been blighted, and now they've ended up tearing a lot of them down. And what we find, there's a famous sociologist / planner named Jane Jacobs, who wrote a book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities, who points out that the strength of cities and what causes them to respond well to stresses is the everyday kind of small interactions. And basically that the smaller the scale, the better equipped our society and our communities are at responding to stresses.
Nice.
Yeah, beautiful. I just have one final question. In Joseph Gordon-Levitt's classic bike messenger movie, Premium Rush, on his bike, he does not use brakes because he's just that cool. Are there brakes on your bike, Spence?
There are brakes on my bike and three gears. There are certain cyclists that enjoy that style of riding, and I'm not one of them.
I'll accept it.
Spence's bike is
like
one of those Flintstones cars, actually. It's not actually a bike. He always goes, yabba dabba doo, on the way to work.
That's right.
Well, thanks for sharing some of your expertise with us, Spence. But we gotta move on. It's just too much fun to chat about these things that maybe only the three of us are interested in.
And you know what? There's points at which I think there's only one or two of us interested in.
Unchained Melodies. So, Steele, this week, the theme was your idea. What are we doing?
Okay, here's what I thought. Our task was to pick a song that we think each other person on the podcast would love, that they would really like, but that they haven't heard before or by a band they don't yet know. So each of us picked one song for each other person on the show, and we're going to play the two songs, and then that person who was chosen for is going to say which one they liked best.
This is an adorable friendship-building episode of Unchained Melodies.
Yes.
Let's just start with me. It's Spence, what do you got for me?
So this is a song called Straight Lines. It's by a singer named Dawn Landis. She was actually married to Josh Ritter, who's a more famous singer-songwriter. I suspect you have not heard it.
I have not. I'm excited.
Remember when we were young, how you asked everyone to marry you, all of those songs we sung, changing all the words you used to make the heroin die.
It's super cute. Yeah, it's adorable. Trampoline and a BMX bike.
That's right up Dave's alley, Spence. Great choice. All right, Dave, I went back and forth on this one. At first I was trying to think, like, what's the song that Dave would sing to his girls every night? And then I was like, nah, that's going to be too obvious. So in the end, I settled on a band named Saint Seneca. Have you heard of these guys before?
No, I haven't.
Okay, good. The song is called On or No.
I saw the light, I saw the light, I saw the light.
and I turned it off.
I saw the light.
I was like, Built to Spill married Colin Malloy. Dave's going to love this.
It's a difficult face-off. It's a super cute girl singing an adorable song versus my natural affinity for a guy that can't really sing. You know,
and doesn't
I
know
that.
Where the beat's supposed to fall.
Yes. I want him to not really be able to play his instrument or know when he's supposed to come in. And yeah,
both sides of your heart are being tugged here, Dave.
Yeah, it's hard to, but I think the Saint Seneca was a little bit more fun. So I think I like that song better. Although I may like Don Landis, the artist, more. I may listen to her more. But if it's that song versus that song, I'm going Saint Seneca. I liked it.
All right, thanks, sorry, Dave.
Good choice, Steel.
All right, we got songs for Spencer here, Dave. What do you got for me?
Yeah. So it was hard because songs that I was picking for Spencer, like he either already knew and enjoyed. We were such on the same page. We're just such good friends. It was hard for me to pick one he didn't already love. Mm. So, but you know, I love it when an artist uses his middle name.
Oh, definitely.
This is Christopher Paul Stelling, and this song is Every Last Extremist.
Don't ever last extremes, wanna tell you how to live. Brother, I got this notion, you're so much more than enough to give. Oh, more than you could ever take, more than you could ever carry alone. Go on and call me an alarmist, I shot and killed the king of thieves. Praying like hell all through the night, thinking all that I had achieved. Come daybreak, we could work, someone else had already gone and filled his greedy shoes. Oh, it's 'cause if you don't play, you lose. Play on some. Came to shoot us in a snake pit, saw the light from up above. Climbed the damp and jagged wall to the source of thereof. I can't tell you about the next password. They reveal just what happened to me then. Yeah, but tell me what you think. My amazing new machine, it does all the things I used to do. What remains to be unseen is after however long it does it for me. In the end, I remember how to do anything myself. Oh, what? You think I do this for my health?
Whew. Guy had a serious Langhorne Slim vibe going on.
Didn't he?
Yeah, that's what Ariane said when we were going through the songs last night. She was like, was that Langhorne Slim? I was like, no, he's not Langhorne Slim at all. Come on. But yes, he is.
I think I might just concede now. I think you won, Dave. That's totally up Spence's alley. I had a tough time with this one for Spence, too. I was like, I need to find a song that's really, really, really slow and that's also sung in a falsetto. So I had two choices, and I think... on the moment, I'm going to actually go with my second choice. This is going to be a band called Strand of Oaks. Do you know them, Spence?
I don't.
Yes, okay, good. The song is called Kill Dragon.
Lately, he hasn't been listening to me. Lately, he hasn't been listening to me. Well, I guess he's a man. And he's meant to leave. Well, I'm standing here right next to me. I got no God who's gonna listen to me. What can I do? What can I do? So I pray the child's prayer I was taught as a little kid. before my head was stretched, before my mother died, before my brother died, before the plague.
The only thing that would make that better if there's a video of this guy singing with his eyes closed.
So that's a tough choice. I'm feeling pulled in different directions too. I'll probably have to go with Steele's based on the fact that his song sounds sadder.
Yeah, Dave, yours had a bit of like hope and humanity in it. It was a little too fun. Spence would never go for that.
Come on, Spence. It was gritty. A little bit of grit.
Dave, I liked your song better than mine. I don't know if that matters.
If I have to choose, I have to go with Steele's, but it's pretty close to a tie. I enjoyed them both.
Falsetto is always the tiebreaker with Spence. Always.
It really is. And if it's like over 6 beats per minute, he's like, nah, it's a little bit too fast, a bit too poppy.
We've got to slow that down. Less cowbell.
Man, I had another choice that was more wienery. I should have gone with it.
You really should have, yeah.
All right, Steele, we got some songs for you.
I'm excited.
So the one I picked, I like the song, but I picked it also a lot while I was thinking about your wife a little bit, actually. It's called Adult Mom, and it's called Survival. And I know that since she's been a mom, it's been work. She's really, it just, as soon as I saw it, as soon as I heard of it, I was thinking about you and your wife. So that's why I picked it.
That is such a Dave song. Dave, that bass line's like right out of the Breeders right there. That was recorded, I swear, in 1994. I love it.
I was going through song choices with my wife last night. Every song I was trying to pick for you sounded like it was from the 90s. I couldn't. I don't know what was going on.
Golden era, Dave. Adult Mom is probably the best band name I've heard in a long time. That's really cool. I wish I had a shirt that said Adult Mom on it.
And my body unprovoked, I set up walls and make sure to include windows. And I cure the pores of my skin. I leave no room for anything. I survive because I have died.
Tough one to beat, Spence.
Yeah, I went for kind of a Hail Mary here. Oh. I know Steele has a soft spot for African music.
Yes.
Especially awesome African music. And this is pretty cool. This is a band called Konono Number 1.
I'm only familiar with Konono's Number 2 and 3. I've never heard the original.
They have an album called Congotronics. And this is Lufuala Ndonga.
Oh!
Spence, that Hail Mary hit the fingertips, almost connected, and it was so close. But I have to say, music alone, that might have won. But Dave's intro, Dave's story, the heart feeling motion. But I got to go with Adult Mom Survival on my choice.
Yes. Yeah.
I should have given you some more background, Steve.
You really should have. You should have pulled at my... I'm all about narrative, Spence. You should know that by now.
Yeah, I should. So I can't resurrect the dropped past now, but they actually pull their instruments out of trash.
Oh, well, just like, it's a time
so
now.
Drums and stuff are all things they find out of the trash heaps.
So they play their instruments from pieces of trash, and Dave's band plays their instruments as if they were trash.
Uh-huh.
That's sweet.
Come on. Let's not rip on Adult Mom. They're really doing their best out there.
That was really fun. We should do that more often. You know, often I listen to songs and I'm like, oh man, this song's terrible, but I bet Dave would love it.
I'm glad you have that thought. Yeah, no, I was invested in each battle. I was like, come on. There's no way Christopher Paul Stelling or whatever his name is. He can't lose to whatever you pick. Well, guys, let's bring this to a close. This has been terrific. I guess, Steele, you got some book wisdom for us.
I do. By the time this launches, the 2 days later will be Father's Day. And I want to pay tribute to my father, my grandfather, all the great men who have been fathers to me in my life in different ways. This is a poem by the great American poet Robert Hayden. It's called Those Winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him, who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices?
Beautiful.
Fatherhood's the best, still. My father, I love him, obviously, but being a father is the best thing I've ever done in life. And you have to make sacrifices. You have to do crazy stuff for your children, but it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you have to sacrifice, because whatever you have to do, it's worth it.
Yeah, I really liked the last two lines. The austere and what was it?
Love's austere and lonely offices.
Yeah.
Spencer says that as his daughter stands right behind him, trying to put her hair into her mouth. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, you guys, I love you. It's been great recording this show. I got to run.
All right. We'll talk to you later, Steele.
All right. Talk to you later. Thanks, Spencer.
Thanks, guys. Off the chain. It's off the chain.
Spencer and his illicit drug dealing.
Just following his life just makes me sad because he achieved some level of popularity and it's just steadily going downhill. Like, we really thought about hosting him at our house before the fever broke.
I have some tricks up my sleeve.
You and your empire of bitcoins. I saw that pin up your nose earlier.
I actually asked Emmeline today what she would do and she said she would cry.
She just giggles. Bungle in the jungle.
Well, I think Dave just died.
Yeah.